You are listening to the Fans of Wrestling Show on the FOW Radio Network. I am Patrick with Danny Danger and Mika Villas. We're back together again, and as always, better than ever. At least better than last week.
At least, hopefully, we don't have the unfortunate production issues we had last week. As you might have noticed, the show being much shorter in duration, a lot of audio issues. So hopefully those are resolved, and we can have a good show.
We found that person who was on the boards there, guys. Hard to do people by themselves when they do some perks. So here we are, you know, back battling, doing what we need to do to get ourselves acoustically and audibly to you.
Excuse me. First of all, there were no problems last week, all right? Our audio came out great. It was fantastic. It was glorious. All right, maybe not necessarily glorious. But people do not have to know that things went wrong. Don't out me like this.
We didn't say
yourself.
It. You just outed yourself.
No. I said things were better than last week, but I didn't say why. It could have been wrestling related, okay? You could have just gone with me. But no, instead, why, a bus, you know, wait till the train gets on and just throw Patrick, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of like, geez, people. This is what I have to expect from my friends.
Well, I mean, I guess, yeah.
With friends like us, you'll never need enemies. That's what they say.
The best of friends, the worst of enemies kind of thing, right? Like, isn't that... Tag partners hit each other harder than your enemies do or something. I don't know.
So we're like good friends, better enemies kind of thing now? Is that where we're going?
The Briscoes fight, but they also like fight together. But sometimes they just want to kick the crap out of each other.
Maybe we'll fight forever. All right. Enough about that. Let's talk some pro wrestling, and let's start with the huge news. The rumor mill out there, of course, right now, it is one of the biggest times for TV networks as it is TV Upfronts Week. And it's basically the week where most major networks come out and have their advertisers out and basically let them see what's coming up. So with that big news coming out that WWE apparently has made a deal to not double, but triple the amount of money that the USA Network and NBC Universal paying them for Monday Night Raw. So apparently for the 3 hours of Monday Night Raw, they're getting a huge pay raise. However, this does not include SmackDown Live, which means they now have the ability to go out to other networks and shop SmackDown Live, which, you know, many people could see that as a lower tier show. Many people call it the B show. But when you look at the stacked talent that they have on SmackDown Live, knowing what type of, numbers they can bring in as a live television event, It could be very attractive to a different network and bring a whole lot more money to WWE.
It could. I mean, three times the amount of money is huge. You know, I mean, so for the fans who were you know, talked at one time, oh, they need to bring Raw back to 2 hours. Yeah, not that's definitely not happening anytime soon. Yeah, not anytime soon. Because they're making too much darn money the other way.
And again,
more and more money coming their way.
People forget that Vince McMahon is a businessman. He is a genius. As CM Punk once famously said, he is a millionaire who should be a billionaire. And I mean, this is part of the reasoning why.
I mean, he's a genius. He'll tell you. You don't even have to ask him, but he'll tell you.
He's a generic jackhammer.
He's all the above with a bigger paycheck for the same product. For the same product, he is making them pay more money. WWE stock went up today because of this announcement. I now have stock in the WWE because I am not a genius. I should. I'm not surprised. And you can I can guarantee you that within the next year or less, SmackDown quite possibly will be on another network because they will take this golden goose egg that is laid and try to spread it to the highest bidder out there. Why? Because it is the best for business.
Well, see, I also heard a rumor through the entertainment websites that that there was possible of Monday Night Raw actually leaving USA Network and going to the network channel. So leaving cable television, and instead of being part of the cable channels on NBC Universal, actually going to NBC, because
No, I heard him going to Fox.
Yeah, there was talk of them going to Fox because Fox was going to be losing some stuff, or sports things were changing nights or something. There was some kind of rumor about them, yeah, about WWE possibly Monday Night Raw going to Fox because Monday Night Football might be going to another channel or something like that. But yet again, that could just be rumors based on what if. Then it leaves a spot for WWE. I don't know, but I mean, there's talk in it, and the fact that WWE stock went up so much based on this deal, as well as talk of, you know, SmackDown possibly getting more money, and depending on how they, you know, whoever decides to take SmackDown, if they do take it separately, you know, maybe some of the shows that are just WWE Network shows, like NXT or something, finally gets an actual channel instead of just the weekly on the WWE Network. You know, maybe after they lose SmackDown in 6 months or whatever, when you know, USA looks and says, oh, well, we're missing some of those ratings on Thursday night. Like, what else do you have for us, WWE? And they say, oh, well, we can, you know, we can give you NXT, or we can give you like NXT and 205, or, you know, whatever we can do. We can do other things. There are other deals out there that they can manipulate, and WWE can always, you know, throw on more reality shows, and, you know, they can take some of the network exclusive stuff and make a version of it that is that would be for TV. So there's a lot of possibilities. So this could be very, very big news for WWE to make a whole lot more money.
You know, and I wonder if this Fox rumors could possibly have been something started by the Fed to kind of scare NBC Universal into paying big money. You know, it's like, hey, we're leaving. You know, there's other parties that are interested. And NBC Universal, of course, apparently values WWE business and Monday Night Raw so much that, hey, they decided, you know, we're not going to give you double what you get. We're going to triple it to keep Monday Night Raw on USA Network. That's very telling. And, you know, it'd be hilarious if McMahon or somebody within WWE started those rumors.
To use them as a bargaining tool. Yeah. I mean, that happens in business all the time.
It's part of marketing 101.
Yeah. Or even, you know, even if WWE, you know, has some contacts within Fox, those people could have leaked that information from a Fox source to whatever media source, you know, like, and just say, oh yeah, we've shown it, you know, there's been interest. They use a lot of vague terminology so that if it comes back, then they can't be like, we never did that. Like, there's been interest. That means we go, sure, this maybe could be cool. Maybe it could work. Like, that's showing interest in something. That doesn't mean there's any pen to paper anywhere. So yeah, it could have absolutely been created somehow through their machine in order to use a bargaining tool, and I mean it technically worked for them.
Yeah, and now, you know, with SmackDown Live being free to whoever, I mean, 2019 is already looking like a great year for profits, you know, and beyond with the new deal, with the TV deals. Now, if as rumored is true, for many years to come, they're going to be doing very well. I mean, they've already making the most money they've ever made in their history. And they look to make even more. So I think as the next year, 2 years go on, and we'll be able to see those figures. Of course, them being a publicly traded company, those numbers do come out. We'll be getting a clear picture. You know, WWE is not going anywhere, first of all, and its current way of doing business is definitely not going anywhere. People can, complain and do, you know, cry foul for whatever about the stars and the quality stuff, but guess what? They're making lots of money, and as long as they're making money,
yeah, they're gonna keep doing things the same way they're doing. Yeah, why change it if it's technically working? They're like you said, a publicly traded company. They're what happens within them focuses on the bottom line, on the top line, the dollar, you know. If they keep making more money doing what they're doing, they're not going to change it. They're going to keep doing what they're doing. That's business 101 right there. You know, you don't, I mean, if it's not broke, you don't, you know, don't fix it.
And man, Vince McMahon, he's, you know, making even more money so he can definitely fund his Alpha Entertainment next year or 2 years from now.
And also his own run for president. In 2024 with Hacksaw Jim Duggan as his running mate.
Hacksaw's getting a cabinet position. He's got, you know, 2x4s. He's going to actually use those to build a cabinet. I think somebody else is going to be the...
It's like a carpentry position, but
it's HUD. He gets HUD
housing.
There we go.
And that becomes a new catchphrase. HUD!
Just like Erwin R. Scheister will probably get
Ministry of Finance or something. Yeah. Within commerce, within the revenue service somehow. Yeah. I mean, he has experience. He has experience in that area, being a Scheister.
So it's kind of a wild thing, but the fact that, you know, I didn't expect it to double, yet triple is mind blowing. That in you know, as we continue to see things going in the way of ratings decline, not just in wrestling, but, you know, we've seen it in sports, we've seen it on TV ratings all across. People are watching less, and a lot of it has to do because of the streaming services and because people are cutting the cable, and I think to that, the fact that, you know, that WWE can get an increase instead of seeing a decrease is great for their business. And, you know, maybe WWE Network is not where they want it to be or where they hoped it'd be, but at least knowing that they're still making so much more money in other venues, in the end, you know, the WWE Network will be the end all of all things, but I think just continuing to be able to keep it at, you know, manageable profits wise and revenue wise where they're not losing money. You know, I mean, they spent a lot of money in the beginning, they made cuts, they made adjustments, and maybe they now have a good base to work with. Kudos WWE to be able to get that much more money for only one show and being able to make even more money later on with SmackDown Live. Somebody's going to pick up SmackDown Live.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Somebody's going to pick it up and pay a whole lot of money for it.
Somebody, anybody, everybody. It depends. I mean, somebody's going to do it, and we're just going to have to wait and see who reaches into the wallet, who cut that big fat check. I shouldn't call it check fat. I mean, that huge check. There we go.
Now, another subject that I wanted to bring up was Money in the Bank. Of course, we'll be talking about it in more in-depth next month when we preview it. But I kind of want to talk about the two women's title matches that I announced. we have Ronda Rousey challenging Nia Jax for the Raw Women's Championship, and then Asuka challenging Carmella for the SmackDown Live Women's Championship. So here I was thinking that those two would probably get more non-title matches to begin with, to possibly make a champion versus champion match at WrestleMania, are put in positions where they kind of have to win. I don't see Asuka losing to Carmella, and I don't see Ronda, you know, getting her undefeated streak broken so soon.
Yeah, I mean, it does put in a weird situation because, in theory, this is only her, you know, her first singles match in WWE, and they're granting her a title shot. So that's kind of strange to begin with. But yeah, then you don't want her to lose. But then you put the championship on her, and does she become like a Lesnar? Like, we don't see her that often. She only defends the belt periodically. Like, it kind of stagnates the division a little bit if you do that. I think there almost has to be some kind of screwball thing, you know, like some kind of weird finish, you know, maybe it goes to a time limit or a double count out or something. That way Ronda doesn't lose, but she also doesn't win the championship, because if you're going to have Ronda come in and beat one person, like the biggest and the baddest and the toughest, like it, at her first shot is very, very strange. It, like, I don't know what it does to the rest of the division. I think they haven't exactly, of course, there's many ways around it, but it appears that they could be painting themselves into a corner. As far as the direction of a lot of things.
Is it really them painting themselves in a corner, or is it them trying to compete with the Joneses, i.e. All In? Because All In sold arena in Chicago, sold out in 29 minutes. And now the WWE has to break out the quote-unquote big guns in order to sell out a pay-per-view, which they are hard-pressed to do, seems like, nowadays, because for many reasons. Like, it could be tip prices, it could be people feel that the product is stagnant or what have you. But they broke out a Ronda Rousey and put her haphazardly in a title match against Nia Jax. Now, I think I've spoken before about how I feel that Nia has come a long way, was not to be the one as far as Raw or any show went. But now we find her as the Raw Women's Champion. Ronda Rousey is someone who has a lot of wrestling skills and the ability to put on a good match outside of working with people like a Triple H and a Stephanie and a Kurt, who have been doing it for years and years and years, can help Ronda look good. I am scared in this match that it is going to be so horrible that it's going to be like Ronda Rousey getting knocked out in her final days of the UFC and her final matches. I don't know if Nia Jax has it in her to have a good match and to bring a good match out of Ronda Rousey. And I don't know if Ronda has it in her to at least be able to deliver without the aid and assistance of a Kurt, Stephanie, and Triple H. It's interesting. People like train wrecks. I think this is a train wreck. I will be watching.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me. I feel like, man, how are they going to do this? How is it going to work? I feel like they need to be able to come up with something that will make it interesting, because I just don't see Nia the way that she's been put and portrayed as somebody really. I mean, okay, you got her, you know, in this anti-bullying campaign, kind of like talking like, you know, don't be a bully, be a star kind of deal. And, well, now you're putting her against Ronda Rousey, who's a tough, you know, person. And she doesn't put up with any crap. Many people have accused Ronda Rousey of being a bully. But here she is, the biggest babyface star in the women's roster. And you put her in this position against this anti-bully person. And also, you know, who's going to carry who in this match? Like, Tamika, I don't know how the match is going to be. You know, Ronda's not ready yet to carry the match herself, you know. And I don't think Nia is there either. As we've seen by the matches she's had with Alexa. Of course, somebody who I dearly love. But I'll say Alexa's still not there yet either. So, a lot of questions to be answered there. The same goes with Asuka and Carmella. You're not going to get Carmella to beat Asuka. It's kind of like, okay, with Charlotte, I can understand that. You know, Charlotte's been the queen of the WWE for a long time. But Carmella, maybe there'll be shenanigans. We'll see this going forward for the whole summer. I don't know. I just don't see how you put these matches together when you could have had many other options available. You have a lot of women in the roster. And yes, I know you had the Money in the Bank match to also deal with, but you have opportunities to put matches together that do not include Ronda or Asuka and title matches, so you can hold off for us a little bit longer. But I guess we'll see what happens. It's I find it interesting. I think it's too soon to see those, unless they plan to do long title runs. Now, I don't think with Rousey, the case will be that she's going to be gone like Lesnar because she is a full-time employee. And Asuka, well, I guess she could have another long title run, but if she's supposed to have a long title run, what's the purpose of her having lost it in the first place?
Ric Flair's daughter.
Choo-choo! Train wreck.
To put over Ric Flair's daughter who's now falling apart on multiple places she's had surgery.
Mouth, boobs, yeah.
Yeah, her veneer got knocked out and boobs falling apart.
Charlotte Flair, like her daddy, is not built to last. Ric Flair might be a cyborg. We need to check into that.
That would understand how dull he is.
He's got that like 70s programming, yeah. He's not up to date. No USB ports on him or anything. Okay, we just like really geeked out. Sorry.
We'll have to find out. We're what? 3 or 4 weeks away, 3 weeks away from Money in the Bank in Chicago. Now, you mentioned this, Tamika.
Thankfully, we're not getting it back-to-back-to-back with another pay-per-view. We have some time in between to rest and kind of relax and not have WWE and their two brands shoved in our face, you know?
Yeah, well, they are shoving two of the brands together. As you know, we have NXT the day before, as this is one of those big 4-day shows that they're having with SummerSlam, the Rumble, WrestleMania, and Survivor Series. And now they added Money in the Bank as the fifth time of the year where they do this. Of course, now you've alluded that, you know, talked about All In in Chicago and, you know, All In selling out in less than the 2 hours. They did it. 10,000 seats, they was their goal. They want to see if they could do it, and they did it. What does this mean for professional wrestling? Can anybody with enough money or anybody with enough names can do this? Or is it just the allure of the Young Bucks, which are the nucleus, I believe, of this thing? You know, as I like to call it, the Too Sweet movement. Because I think it's grown beyond Bullet Club. But the fact that they've been able to get a lot of big names, of course, in addition to the Bucks and Cody Rhodes, we have Kenny Omega and Okada on the card, amongst many others.
So here's the concern I have, I guess. Like, so we saw how well the ticket sales did for the first New Japan show in LA. It didn't sell out that fast, but it was a very strong ticket sales. I can't recall off the top of my head if it did in fact sell out or not, but the ticket sales were very, very strong right off the bat. For the, you know, the we they've had another date, you know, another New Japan show in the United States, and ticket sales aren't nearly as strong. So ticket sales, you know, can be really strong for one event, and maybe once the after you do the novelty, the struggle is come back. So the Bucks, yes, they do this, and they're showing that you can, you know, like, it is possible to do this outside of a, you know, quote unquote major company, right? Like, literally, this is the wrestlers putting this shit together themselves. So they're showing that it can be done. I don't know if it can be replicated other places and other instances, or it's just one of those type things where so many pieces came together at the right time at the right place, and it's going to happen. So if in 6 months or 4 months or whatever, after this event, they go for a second one, that may be the big tell of how possible it is. Is it just because it has this WrestleMania effect where it's going to be, this is the only way it's going to be this way. You know, you're going to see all this talent at one time in one place. It's the Bucks show. We all want to be there for the Bucks first show, etc. But when it comes down to, oh, it's going to turn into a semi-regular thing, like, does the allure die? If you had a WrestleMania every 3 or 4 months, does the appeal of WrestleMania diminish? You know, is that why monthly pay-per-views only run in 15,000 seat arenas instead of the 100,000 seat arenas that WrestleMania can pull? You know, like, there's so much more that they do to WrestleMania to make it stand out. So this is like the independence, especially for the elite of the Bullet Club. It's the WrestleMania. How does the show do? Is there going to be recording? Is it going to be, you know, apart from just the ticket sales, where does it go? How much bigger can it get? And then the next question becomes, okay, so one show reached this big. Do you dare go for two? And if so, does two do nearly as well? I think we answer a lot of questions, or we answer less questions than we can ask based on it. But I mean, it is amazing, and it does show what you can, that there is still the DIY spirit, and that you can do things independently in wrestling.
If you build it, they will come.
If you build the right thing, the right people will come. Yeah.
Let me throw this out like this. No offense to our boys, but Cody and the Bucks carnied this like a motherfucker. They talked about it on all their social media. They just hashtagged all in. They had other workers. They had other workers going, I want to be all in. People they had not reached out to, had not talked to, had not thought about booking or said anything about it. They just said, we're going to go here, Chicago. I am biased as hell, y'all, but you can admit, because the WWE will say it when they're there, that Chicago is a great wrestling city. It is one of the wrestling destinations as far as the WWE is concerned, and it is the mecca of the Midwest, so to speak. They got a 10,000 seat arena in Chicago, a wrestling city, where you have not had a wrestling event of this magnitude. Now, yes, I know they're doing Money in the Bank there, but to have something new, fresh, and different outside of WWE roll into the city for reasonable prices was something that city, I speak for my city, clamoring for. Chicago is easy to get to, much like Atlanta, a hub for airlines. Prices, tickets, not that hard to get on a plane, a train, not far as automobiles go. So it's easy to get to this show. This show has guys that you would not see as far as Cody and the Young Bucks in a typical thing, little venues outside of Chicago, and not some place that most people in the city would like kind of venture to. But again, this was, like you said, was it a mix of the perfect storm? This was a perfect storm. You had Cody and the Bucks talking about it, where workers were excited and wanted to be a part of it because they knew it was different. that it was historic, much like that first New Japan show here in America. You had, you've got Chicago, a great city where fans are like, well, hell, I can get to Chicago easy. It's my backyard. It's this far away. No problem. Everybody bought into All In, and from workers to fans, everybody is literally all in for this show. Now, if they do it again and they do it outside of Chicago, or if they do it on a regular basis where it just saturates, or if this show somehow flops, which I don't see that happening with the talent that they have on the show, then yes, it will be one of those things like, oh, they did it the first time and they should have left it alone. Don't keep poking at it. But Cody's smart. The Bucks are genius when it comes to their brands, their individual and collective brands. They know the vision, or they have a vision, and they know where they want to take their brands and how to portray them. I can see All In 2 being just as successful as long as they keep some of the same formulas together, meaning if they go anyplace outside of Chicago, they need to go to another quote-unquote great wrestling city, pull a small venue, not try to do huge football stadiums worth of sales, because that's not what it's about. You want it to be special and limited, and you want to, again, have all your wrestling buddies and even those non-buddies want to be, have a piece of what you're offering up to the world. It's great. I wish I was going. Who knows? It's my hometown. I know ways into that arena. I'm just saying. Who knows? Maybe I'll be all in, guys.
Yeah, what they're doing is definitely something else, and I definitely think that they can have more success. Now, I don't think that they're going to be doing a promotion. I've heard Cody talk about what he's seen about running a promotion with his dad running Turnbuckle Championship Wrestling or whatever it was that he called it here in Georgia. So I don't think he's looking to do a promotion, but special shows like this, you know, couple times a year, but you know how things are. You start one show, it's successful, then you want to do another, then you want to do another, and you know the money's gonna be good. They were able to sell out 10,000. Can we sell out 15,000? Can we sell out 20,000? That's gonna get in their heads. A lot of question marks, but you know, good for them that they were able to sell out their arena, and apparently they're doing a huge weekend of things with a lot of wrestler meet and greets, a lot of podcasts going on with partly, you know, here with the Starcast. So it's going to be a huge weekend. AEW is also putting two shows that weekend before, I believe, to company All In. So kudos to Cody and the Bucks, and you know, who knows? Look, let's not forget, if I remember correctly, that's how PWG got started. You know, a group of wrestlers who were friends who wanted to put out, you know, a show, and they did that. And look at when two grew now. You know, is back in the day, it was PWG was a place that you went to then get started and then became a name. Now you have to become a name to give it, to even be considered to be put on PWG. So will All In be something like that in the future? I don't know. Again, only time will tell. And now, well, the main reason that we're here, other than to talk to one another, it's to talk about a wrestling event that happened a long, long time ago. And we're going to take a blast from the past. We're going, taking that, you know, time machine and going to 1996, Daytona, Florida. The event, Bash at the Beach, 1996. Now, before we actually do get started on the show itself, I want to talk a little bit about where were we in July of 1996, wrestling fan-wise, okay? I'll start with myself. In 1996, I was all pun intended, all in on WWE and WCW. Okay, we're talking about the beginnings of the Monday Night Wars here, and I was one of those kids who, you know, was going from channel to channel, you know, back and forth between TNT and the USA Network. I remember that at some point I started taping these shows. And man, commercial breaks, I was just going back and forth and trying to decide which one I wanted to actually watch live. And at this point, you know, it was great. For me, I loved it. I just had two shows on Monday night, fill up my entire Monday night. And to me, it was huge. I knew how to speak English 100% fluently at this point. So I was understanding everything. So that's where I was. I was all in. I was watching it all. I was taking it all in, watching all the pay-per-views. At that time, I was still watching, you know, wrestling also on Saturdays with Superstars as well as Saturday Night Wrestling on WCW. What was it for you guys? Where were you guys on your pro wrestling spectrum in 1996?
In 96, like, that was towards the time before I really got back into wrestling heavy. When I was young, I used to watch WWF on the Saturday morning, you know, Saturday mornings. And that was kind of it. And then I got a little bit older and some of my friends were like, oh, you know, that. So my friends stopped watching it. So I kind of didn't watch it as much. So I was kind of there and I hadn't come back around to wrestling yet. So in 1996, I wasn't back as a wrestling fan regularly. So I actually didn't watch this show live when it happened. I didn't go back to being a wrestling fan until maybe about a year later. I would think it was probably later. It's probably almost a year later before I really got into it hardcore. I was flipping back and forth with the Monday Night Wars and all that stuff.
Wow, July 1996.
She wasn't even born yet.
Hey, I don't even know if I really was alive. That's kind of crazy. Like, I was such a nerd as a child. I think in my room reading a book, and I would have caught, like, maybe about this show with some of the guys that I hung out with, and maybe watched it later, like, perhaps a year or so later when they said, oh, did you see the beginning of the NWO or whatever? But yeah, I'm almost like positive I wasn't watching wrestling, like Danny said, even at all during this time frame, because my little nerdy self was stuck in a book or there was something else on TV, because, you know, that's also, you had to have cable to watch wrestling, and I did not have cable back in 1996, so, you know, kind of hard to do the wrestling thing without cable.
All right, well, now that we know where we were, crazy things. In 1996, I did not had yet discovered the dirty sheets. So, here, I mean, I knew it wasn't real, okay? I knew it was scripted.
Whoa. What are you trying to say there, bud? You trying to say something about wrestling? It's real. I mean, I see it. I've been to shows. It's real. It's there. It happens.
It hit each other hard. It's crazy.
What are you trying to say?
I knew that it was scripted. I knew that, at least that, okay? Is that better?
No, but go ahead.
It Well, yeah, scripted. They got a script. That's how they know what match happens and then what the second match is. And
I was totally all over the place when the crossovers happen and the outsiders, as they were first known, of course, at Bash at the Beach, but showed up. So let's set the stage for Bash at the Beach, 1996. With a lot of things, you know, the feuds from the winter and the spring had started to dwindle, at least most of them. Things were slowly kind of shifting. And, well, everything shifted 100% in Memorial Day weekend in 1996 as one artist formerly known as Rey Sol Ramon. And at this time, no name. We knew who it was, though. He showed up out of nowhere, confronted the announcers, and said that they were taking over. Who's they? Well, a few weeks later, they became the second outsider, the artist formerly known as Diesel. And so from there, you see Scott Hall and Kevin Nash in WCW, where the big boys play. And everybody's like, they're taking over. What, Vince sent them over? You know, is WWE on a mission to take over WCW, and this is the beginning? And, well, things went on from there. They continued to come in and interrupt, the TV show on Monday nights. And then they got a match. Bash at the Beach is going to be 3-on-3. And Eric Bischoff would not tell the outsiders who their opponents would be. So he got powerbombed through a table at the Great American Bash. The next day, a drawing was made. A drawing was done to determine who would face the outsiders, Hall, Nash, and the third man. And it was and it was Sting, Randy Savage, and Lex Luger. So there we go. The set stage, your main event. It is Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and a third man versus Randy Savage, Sting, and Lex Luger. So basically, we go through June, July now. The summer's in full effect. Bash at the Beach is coming, and we're getting ready for action. Hostile takeover. These guys are coming from somewhere else up north trying to take over WCW. It's everything everybody can talk about. We have many other stories, of course, happening. But everything revolves around these two men and who the third man is. All right? And throughout the whole show, Bash at the Beach, people were wondering who will be the third man. We wouldn't find out until the very, very end of the night when the New World Order, or as the third man said, the New World Organization, was formed. The NWO was born at Bash at the Beach. But before we get there, let's rewind to the beginning. And let's kick off with the opening match, which is a match, well, of course, the best way you want to open any kind of wrestling match, right? With high flying and spot and flippy moves. And you get your luchadors over there to do the job and get people hyped up. And you have a very young Rey Mysterio Jr. versus Psicosis. And I enjoyed the match. They did pretty good. Apparently, all the luchadors had a match in Mexico the night before, or so they said. So they had to travel overnight to be a Bash at the Beach. But you know what? A very fun opening match. I believe one of the longest matches of the evening. And everything you expect out of Lucha Libre, which I'm a huge fan of, as well as two guys who were not even at their peak yet, but they were getting there. To start off, kickoff Bash at the Beach 1996. What'd you guys think of the opening contest?
I mean, it was, like you said, it was very lengthy, you know, consider, especially when you look back and consider the rest of the card. But the big thing is that early on, it seemed that the crowd really wasn't that into it, you know, okay, whatever. But as they went on, the crowd got more and more into the action. And I mean, in the, you know, Psicosis and Rey Mysterio Jr., two of the guys who helped, you know, pioneer Lucha Libre in the United States. And so this is still on the earliest aspects of that before the cruiserweight division really took over. And then, of course, after WCW fell, then you went on to, you know, cruiserweights and lighter weight guys being pushed in WWF as well. But it was a fun match. I want to talk real quick before we go into the show further. I want to talk about the commentary, because I felt that the commentary throughout did a very poor job of explaining the stories in the individual matches at hand.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of talk about, you know, who's the third man? What happened to Eric Bischoff? Nobody's heard from him since he got powerbombed off that stage and went to the hospital. Is he even here tonight? Is he coming tonight? What does he know? Does he, you know, who knows this? There was the whole thing of trying to find out who third man was. You know, were Sting and his troop going to be ready for the outsiders? You know, like, what were the outsiders going to bring in all this? And throughout the night, and I get that, but I still don't feel they did a very good job of explaining not only the stories of the individual matches. By the time the last match came, they kept talking about it all night long as though it was a takeover, okay? As though there were some kind of stakes on the line, and they mentioned that, oh, if these guys win, like, are we even going to have jobs tomorrow? Like, is there even going to be a Monday Night Raw, or is it just going to be Monday Nitro, or is it just going to be the test colors on the screen? Like, was there any kind of stipulation about if they win that they gain ownership of World Championship Wrestling? Was there any kind of stipulation or anything said anywhere that they would actually, like, take control of the company by winning one match? Like, I don't feel that was ever explained, but they talked as though it was a big thing, you know? Of course, it's the most important night in professional wrestling history. Little did they know that it would actually be one of the most important nights in professional wrestling history at that time. But they continually said that, and that was is now the running joke with Shivani, is that every single Monday Nitro was the most, you know, this could be the most important night in professional wrestling history. But so that is my thing, because there were a lot of, especially the first few matches, like this match, you know, they brought in Mike Tenay to do commentary because he's, you know, he's the Lucha Libre guy. He knows all the cool names of the moves, and all the guys are, you know, talking about how, oh, he knows all the moves names. How do you know the name to that? Like, they're like going back and forth and stuff.
Oh, that was probably one of my favorite Tony Schiavone lines. How do you know the name of the moves? Well, if you don't know, just make it up.
Yeah, jeez. Yeah, so, yeah, because he's like, Hurricane Rana, like, you know, that sounds made up, you know, like, but so that was the thing. So they brought him today, and then, like, after that match, bye, today, we got an actual show to do. We don't need you anymore.
Like, it's almost like he wasn't there.
He was the professor, and he came in for the cruiserweight match, and then he literally, like, left the booth. But so in that match, you know, you had Tanay giving background story about it. But then every other match the rest of the night, you know, there were like three or four like gimmick matches, like right in a row after this match. You had like three unusual gimmick matches with stipulations that were kind of weird. They didn't really explain. Like, I don't feel they gave enough backstory to the matches as to why this match was happening and why it was a gimmick. Like, they would make allusion to some of it, but like, I guess they expected everybody to watch, and they made mention to some kind of pregame show. So So maybe like the before it went on air for pay-per-view, there was a pre-show that went over all that. But the thing is, like, you still got to hit on that stuff. Because, like, you go into – yeah, well, I mean, we'll talk about those next couple matches as we go into them.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree with that. The commentary was everything I expected it to be. It was just
– well, they hyped the show and they sold stuff well, you know, sold moves and sold the show and talked, you know, the big story. But as far as the stories of the individual matches, they didn't really go into. For the most part, present within the current match. You know, they did talk about the main event a lot, but it's the main event. In theory, that's the match you paid the money to see. But they talked enough about the matches and put them over well. It's just I felt that as far as the story as to why and why we're having this unusual stipulation, or, you know, why this matchup came to be, I don't think they did a good job of conveying.
It was a horrible job. It was confusing at commentary for a lot of the pay-per-view. It was interesting to watch the late, great Bobby the Brain Heenan as he kind of ran around and did his kind of heel announcer things. I guess I should say something nice.
You get to hear the dream, maybe. You got to hear the dream on the commentary, and they always make fun about when he talks and stuff, and he says things like, "We're bringing out some plunder," and they're like, "What exactly is plunder, Dream? Can you kind of explain that to us?" Well, it's like the furniture and all this stuff they bring in. So if you're moving from a house to another house, like, are you bringing along your plunder? No. It's more like a professor. Like they made fun of things he said, like, you know, if you will, and all that was some of my favorite stuff. Listening to old WCWs is literally listening to the amazingly hilarious Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah, it was good. It was interesting. It was amazing that opening contest to see young Rey Mysterio Jr. As he is much smaller back then, and to see Psicosis, and as the pay per view went on, to see some young faces that are more familiar to us as older competitors and what have you. So it was a great Lucha Libre match. It bothered me that this was like apparently the first time they'd ever seen Mexicans because they kept talking about it. But, you know, hey, whatever. It was a great match.
Non-Conan Mexicans, it was pretty much the first time.
Well, there was definitely a lot going on. And, of course, at least, you know, Tanay did kind of bring up that this was not the first time that these two had wrestled. They had history back in Mexico and whatnot, kind of helped tie things up. I will agree, yeah, the announcers did not do a very good job of telling exactly how these people were brought to this point. But heck, that's what we're here, to correct the wrongs of announcers in the past. So moving on, the next match, of course, Rey Mysterio Jr. defeated Psicosis. The second match, we had John Tenta versus Big Bubba in a Carson City Silver Dollar match.
There was a sock full of silver dollars on a pole,
which neither of the contestants could reach. It was so high, and they're too big to try to climb that pole.
Yeah, Big Bubba came out with Jimmy Hart. For whatever reason, the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, was managing Big Bubba, formerly known as the Big Boss Man.
Well, let me set the mood for you here, okay? So the Dungeon of Doom was a group that was created with Kevin Sullivan as a taskmaster to rid the world of Hulkamania. So at one point, John Tenta, then known as the Shark, was a member of the Dungeon of Doom, as was Big Bubba. And Jimmy Hart was their manager.
How many guys were in the Dungeon of Doom at that time? Because there was a thing later, and I saw like three or four other dudes. So I don't remember any of them being in Dungeon of Doom. I didn't know the Dungeon of Doom. The whole reason they created it was to get rid of Hulkamania, which they failed at miserably.
So that was the thing, and so Shark got kicked out of the Dungeon of Doom.
He was known as Shark when he first came in. He was the earthquake in WWF, and that's only what I remembered him as.
Yeah, so he was the Shark as he was part of the Dungeon of Doom.
Okay.
So he got kicked out, and him and Ray Trailer were feuding. And this was right here the culmination with the Silver Dollar sock.
Why was it determined that they would have a sock full of silver dollars to hit each other with? Was there something in the feud leading up to that where one of them hit somebody with a sock full of silver dollars? Big Bubba had silver dollars and had hit people with a sock full of them.
Right.
When I was in 1996, if you had a silver dollar, it was something kind of cool because you didn't see him that often. So this guy just carries around like sockfuls of them.
Part of the wrestling business, brother, where you just, you know, carny it up.
You know, so some guys do suck it in, right?
Sock it to you. That kind of thing. But then they put it like on a pole, like you said. So the two guys, they talked of John Tenta being over 500 pounds, which he didn't look 500 pounds there, but I don't know. And yeah, neither guy could really, even standing on top rope, touch the pole, or touch the sock. You still had to like climb the pole to get the sock full of things. And neither of these guys had an easy time trying to do that.
It was one of the most interesting and ridiculous things I've ever seen because they were both too big to actually climb this pole. It wasn't like a regular pole. This was like an extended 80-foot pole. This was a Money in the Bank ladder match pole where at the top of the pole would be equivalent to where the briefcase hangs over the middle of the ring. These were heavy guys. These were not little, small guys. These were huge, behemoth guys. And there was no way in hell they were climbing that pole. Like, it was physically impossible for them to climb the pole to get this sock full of silver dollars. And it's not like the modern day equivalent where if you pull down a briefcase, it's yours and you get to, you know, use the contents. If you pull down the sock, you get to use it, but you still have to pin or submit your opponent. So the sock was just literally a loaded weapon. I was happy to see Glacier, a young Glacier. I was happy to see John Tenta, but you know, I liked Earthquake better. I liked seeing Jimmy Hart. But I hated that this match went on for as long as it did because it dragged. But I'm assuming that in 1996, this is what constituted entertainment and people loved it. I'm sorry about their lack of a life back in the day.
Well, like, okay, so John Tenta, he appeared to have half of his head shaved and half of it not.
Right, because Big Bubba had shaved his head.
Yeah, but see, they didn't say that explicitly. Hey, leading up to this, you know, they didn't show any clips. They didn't talk about that. When Bubba or who was it? Jimmy Hart got, yeah, he brought the scissors in to try to cut the remaining mullet of John Tenta. They mentioned something about, oh, he's going to get the rest of it. So, like, that was the only mention they did to him cutting the hair, and then they use the scissors later to kind of is one of the attempts to try to cut the something that was holding up the zip ties that were holding the pole to the ring post. Right. And then he eventually, like, Jimmy Hart snaked up and got it. And then they kind of both used it on each other, you know, or tried to, and all. It was a struggle to see who'd get to use it. But like, so the fact that they didn't, that the commentators during the match was happening didn't explain any of this, the fact that we had to explain this to each other right now shows how terrible of a job they did. That you had to go with me through the Dungeon of Doom and who they were and who all was in there and that Tenta used to be a part of that and that Bubba is currently a part of it and that they, during this, he and Bubba fought and Bubba shaved half of his head and he hit him with some silver dollars or something at one point and now that's why they now have a legal attempt to use silver dollars in a wrestling match on each other. And here's why Bubba's pulling out scissors to try to cut the rest of his hair for whatever reason. Like, they didn't explain any of this. They explained the moves, and they talked about getting up the pole and all these things. They talked about stuff in the here and now, but they didn't talk about what brought them to the here and now, which to me is the big issue, was the big issue throughout the night, especially in the undercard matches, because some of the bigger matches through history, you know, we remember the feuds and what led to them a bit. But some of those are undercard stuff, like, yeah, I'm like, what the heck is this? What's going on? And they're explaining it while it's, you know, when they come out, I'm like, a sock full of silver dollars? This is something, what? And then I never got an answer to why.
Well, going back with the gimmick matches here, we continue on to a taped fist match. And of course, this is because Jim Duggan is very well known to be good at the punching. So we're going to do tape fist. And of course, this was for Diamond Dallas Page's Battle Bowl ring, which he had won back at Slamboree in earlier 1996.
So they didn't explain this backstory either.
Right. You know, they didn't explain anything about, oh, Diamond Dallas Page went from hobo to now, you know, back in good fortunes.
Riches to rags to back to riches or something. But that was kind of all they've said.
The best part of all that was that Kimberly, the booty babe, took his money, but he got it back. I was like, dude, they just said booty babe. I don't know, in 96.
A bunch of times they said booty babe, yeah.
Yeah, because she had left him and she was not with the booty man.
Oh, that's why she was the booty babe, because she was with the booty man. See, they didn't explain that either. So you have taped fist, but they didn't even explain, like, why a taped fist is supposed to be more dangerous than a regular fist. Because Diamond Dallas Page, like, cut a minute and a half into the match, cuts the tape off Hacksaw's hands, okay? And, like, I guess it was supposed to be a big thing. Oh, no, now DDP has his hands taped, but Duggan doesn't. Like, is that an advantage or disadvantage? Like, it's not like he, you know, there was a lot of things that happened that commentary didn't do a good job of explaining. Yet again, the story of why they were fighting over the Battle Bowl ring, would have helped, and attempting to explain the science, you know, the quote unquote wrestling science behind why a fist that's taped really heavily hurts more than a fist that's not taped heavily. And why you can't just tape your fist really heavy for a regular match if, in fact, having heavier tape on your hands hurts more. So just a lot of stuff they didn't explain. The weird match. Because also the DDP I knew when I started watching wrestling was him. He was already like the underdog babyface working towards the people's champion and stuff. So even going back now and watching him wrestling as a heel is kind of like throws me off sometimes just by itself, because it's not nearly what I'm used to. It's not the DDP I ever knew until, you know, the last couple of years, really, that I've gone back and watched that early stuff. Because I 6-7 years ago, I used to watch the AWA stuff on ESPN Classic, but DDP didn't wrestle there. But he was the manager of the Diamond Exchange and all this. So I know that persona. I just didn't see him wrestling as that persona. An odd gimmick match, beginning of the show, undercard, not explained well, story behind the gimmick not explained well, but the live action was called, you know, correctly and properly.
Diamond Dallas Page is victorious, and he retains the Battle Bowl ring
with the diamond cutter out of nowhere, the original out of nowhere, because he could hit it from anywhere. And he didn't have to, like, leap into it and have you leap midair with him to catch the move, which also always astounds me. If I'm in a fight with somebody and they're right in front of me and they start to jump in the air, I'm not necessarily just going to jump in the air willy-nilly behind them. just so that we're both in the air.
I thought this was a pretty good match, though. It was short match, under 6 minutes.
Yeah, well, no, and the match was fine. You know, they're both good, solid guys, and DDP knew how to play that persona well. I'm also just ripping on every time somebody does a cutter now. Both guys are airborne before they even grab the head. Where DDP always grabbed you and pulled you down.
You guys said it all.
Didn't want to talk about hacks on DDP. The realest Americans ever.
I wasn't feeling the bang, y'all. I really wasn't. The booty babe was the highlight of that for me.
This is nothing but bangs and hoes for her.
How long have you been waiting to pull that joke out?
I literally just came up with that one.
Oh, okay. I thought you like came up with it like a week ago when you saw the match, and you're like, oh man, I'm gonna drop this joke. It'll be awesome.
Dawned on me.
It would have been better had you like planned the joke well ahead of time. That would have made a more interesting story.
Yeah, I've been planning it for a long time, Danny. That's what chose the show.
That's it. You saw this like 6 months ago, and you're like, man, I need to share this joke with somebody who'll get it. I'm gonna make these guys watch the show, and we'll talk about it. And then I'm gonna drop this joke, and it's gonna be awesome. It wasn't even a groaner.
So next up, we get another gimmick match, a double dog collar match. The Nasty Boys versus Public Enemy.
It's the Nasty Boys and the Public Enemy. There's not much of a story to tell. They're two tag teams that like to fight hardcore matches. So, you know, I assumed that they had probably had several matches, and this was just another way, you know, so that you're not just having hardcore match after hardcore match, street fight after street fight. So we'll put them in dog collars. I mean, it was fun. It was entertaining for what it was. You know, it was dirty and nasty, and they hit each other with stuff. It was the one match. These WCW shows that had like the odd stage setups, there was always one match that went up to the stage setup and wreaked havoc around it. So that's what they did. They went up and played around the beach set and hit each other with the surfboard and, you know, elbow drop into the sand, like off the lifeguard tower. Like they did all that silly stuff this match. And then the rest of the show, they didn't touch the setup anymore. But this match seemed like it went on a long time. This match seemed like it went on too long.
Yeah, over 11 minutes.
I mean, I enjoyed it, but it felt like I kind of enjoyed it. But there were times I was just like, man, this thing's still going on. Thing's still going on. Like, I didn't right. I don't know if they just like took it to the out. Like, just the pacing was weird or what. But it just felt like really long.
Somebody went over to the time, I bet you. It was one of those matches where I was like, ooh, dog collar match, double dog collar match. You know, I've seen one of these live in person. So let me watch this 96 reincarnation, so to speak. It was ultra violent for the time, but I think for that beach spring breaky crowd, it was just like, oh, well, whatever. Perhaps because I wasn't vested in the Nasty Boys or the Public Enemy, I really didn't care about this one other than the fact that I thought it was kind of like cool to see again a double dog collar match. But watching these four guys, no disrespect, put me to sleep.
All right, well, Nasty Boys victorious. And I'll just say this, Public Enemy, man, if done right, at the right time, they could have done a lot of great stuff with the Dudleys and WWE. I think by the time that they got there, it was just like, it didn't work. And I'll tell you, it didn't fully work also in WCW all the time. But man, you know, it was something about that ECW magic that worked so well for Public Enemy. It sucks that it couldn't be replicated in you know, them places like WWE when the brief time they were there, and then long term in WCW. But that's not here or there. All right, so next we get a WCW Cruiserweight Championship match. The Man of 1,000 Holds, Dean Malenko, defends the championship against Disco Inferno, who's busier worrying about his dancing than he is about his wrestling. And here we go, a match, Dean Malenko basically doing most of the beating, eventually just defeating Disco Inferno. It was a good match, 100% on Dean Malenko. Inferno did a good job being the base and taking all the beating, but it was basically a one-sided affair when it came to this match.
Yet again, they didn't really explain what Disco Inferno had. Well, no, yeah, he did. They said that he disrupted Malenko after Malenko had won a match on Nitro or something. That was kind of what they said, and that Dean Malenko felt highly disrespected, which is why Dean Malenko, usually the Iceman, came in very, very pissed, very emotional going into this, and just started laying into Disco. There was no tactician feeling you out strategy. He just went in there and started messing Disco up like Disco literally owed him money. And then Disco's coming back and, you know, has some hope spots and starts kind of doing some things, but Malenko beats him. But the commentators, you know, their big thing is putting over, oh, Disco earned the respect of, you know, a lot of the wrestlers and the fans here tonight too. No, he didn't. I guess at that time they thought that the Disco Inferno could move higher up and be more than he was, but he never was more than he was right there.
He was a lost throwback to a different era where Disco was dead, but they were digging this kid out who had a great look, a great body, and give him the gimmick with the, you know, the Elvis impersonator. It just doesn't work.
But it worked to some extent, and here we had Mr. Personality, Disco Inferno with all the dancing and the disco fever, and then the guy who many people have accused of having zero personality because of him being a serious professional wrestler, Dean Malenko. I think he did it well to be played off.
But the problem with Malenko being zero personality is that it worked for him. It was a gimmick, okay? The problem now is there are so many guys who wrestle and they have zero personality. Their gimmick is not having zero personality. They just have zero personality. They might even have a gimmick. They just don't play the gimmick because they have zero personality. For Malenko and eventually for Lance Storm several years later, it was their gimmick. It was their gimmick to be super serious, no nonsense, especially in the world of colorful characters. Now you have a mix, so much of a mix that there, especially in the independent scene, there are fewer colorful characters and more guys who just want to be a serious competitor. But the thing is, they're not making serious competing their gimmick. They're just not having a personality and not having a gimmick. So it was never a knock against Malenko. People dug him. People liked him. And he was a fan favorite. But yeah, they didn't really go into the whole explain the big dichotomy between the two as well as they could have.
So next, we go to Steve McMichael versus Desperado Joe Gomez. Now, let's go back a little bit, back to the Great American Bash, and this is where Steve McMichael turned on Kevin Green and he joined the Four Horsemen. So then he comes on here at Bash at the Beach and this is his first singles match in WCW as part of the Four Horsemen and faces Joe Gomez in a match that I thought it was too long. Absolutely. It felt like this was twice as long as it actually was. And, man, one of my biggest pet peeves is wrestlers not knowing how to sell. Dude, you know, Mongo could not even sell you free water.
Mongo, the problem with Mongo, too, is he never got any better. Like, you watch even the way he was hitting the ropes. Like, he would, as he was running towards the ropes, reach his hand out, physically grab the rope with his hand, lean into that arm and come off the ropes that way. He wouldn't actually touch his back to the ropes when he'd hit them. He would like kind of crook his arm against the rope and fall sideways kind of against his arm and run back out. And like, I guess this was meant to be a squash match with the, you know, a guy who was like this super low level up and comer possible that the fans were supposed to get behind. a guy who just, you know, who never went anywhere for whatever reason. But when the jobber looks better than the guy you're trying to put over, I think you have a problem. And the jobber didn't even look that great. He was throwing these weird drop kicks where he was like, he'd jump in the air or something. He'd kind of throw, he'd start to look like throw what he was doing, like a super kick, and then just kind of like move his other foot closer towards it and fall on the ground. Like, it wasn't like a jump, extend your legs and kick. It wasn't like, you know, hit the guy with your feet, then extend and drop. Like, there was no form to this drop kick. It was also just really, everything about this match just looked really terrible. And I firmly agree when you said it felt like it went on for 2.5 years.
Steve McMichaels, the premier athlete. Wait, no, that's not who he was during that time frame, right? I mean, fresh off the gridiron of the Chicago Bears with Deborah, a young, hot Deborah, and Dog in tow. I don't remember Joe Gomez. I don't remember of Joe Gomez, where Joe Gomez went, where he came from. Was he under a hood or mask before? Is he under one now? These are questions that nobody in the world has ever asked, and I don't think anybody actually cares to ask, along with where Steve McMichaels now. Again, these are things we don't care about. It was interesting because McMichaels was relatively quick to stardom in wrestling because he instantly joined the Four Horsemen. So that's what interested me in the match, that here is McMichael, who is literally green as grass, already a part of the Horsemen. So I wanted to see his performance. Wasn't bad, wasn't the best, but it was good enough to pick up the win and to walk out of there head held high along with Deborah and the Dog.
So Steve McMichael picks up the win, and on to the next match we go. Ric Flair challenges Conan for the United States Championship.
Oh my goodness. Talk about a match that felt like it went on forever. Holy crap. When I saw earlier and Conan cut that really bad rambling promo where like he wasn't really sure what he wanted to say and just kind of kept talking and talking, I was like, oh my goodness, this is going to be bad. Like, because this is when they actually tried to push Conan as like a real wrestler instead of like the gangster. Like, he hadn't donned that persona yet. I was like, this is going to be bad. He's going to be fighting Flair. Oh, man. Like, even in 96, Flair had been wrestling like 140 years and was not any better than he was 140 years earlier. Like, I honestly let this match play while I played on my phone the entire time. I was entirely uninterested, and it just kept going and going and going and going. And I honestly, because I was paying that little attention, I can't even tell you who won.
Well, Ric Flair won, became the new United States champion. But look, at this point, Conan was actually good. You know, he was actually in shape, and he was a good wrestler. Let's not forget that less than a year ago, Conan in Mexico was like Hulk Hogan. He was huge. You know, he was on the top of the world. And he was doing soap operas, and he was doing all these kind of things. He was on TV. He was all over the networks. Conan was a superstar. Then he came to WCW and then got fat and lazy, and other luchadors got better.
Yeah, Conan's biggest contribution to wrestling in the United States is more as behind the scenes, helping bring more of Lucha Libre into the United States, helping, you know, that's where his contributions in the United States lie. He helped, you know, orchestrate deals and bring in, you know, Psicosis and Rey Mysterio, and later guys like, you know, who are also part the luchadors in the Cruiserweight division, Liz Mark Jr. and El Dandy. Like, he was the linchpin that helped bring and start all that in. But as far as anything he's done in front of a camera, I've never been a fan of. Except, with the exception of the original incarnation of the LAX. When it was him and Hernandez and Homicide, and you had Sarita in there too. Like, I thought that was some money stuff. But anything else that Conan's done, I've never been interested in.
So the match was good. It was decent. I can't, I'm not going to hate it. I did enjoy it. But the ending was clunky with the ladies and the shoe, which woman had done many a times.
Yeah, and there was that weird thing where woman was kind of trying to like seduce Mean Gene, like the promo Flair cut earlier. It was weird too. So that whatever momentum and interest I had as the show went on, it died there. And then I had difficulty attempting to recover it as the show continued.
For me, this pay-per-view, it could be I'm too modern. It dragged. It really did. I mean, there were some good points along the way to the finale, but I didn't feel that this was one of those good points.
So then we move on to the semi-main event, the co-main event, whatever you want to call it. The last match before the main event, the Giant and the Taskmaster versus Arn Anderson and Chris Benoit. And if Benoit and Anderson defeated the Taskmaster and the Giant, then one of the four horsemen would get a title shot at the Giant's WCW Heavyweight Championship.
Which to me in modern day is odd that the championship was not defended on a pay-per-view. I mean, like, well, it's odd because the errors we went through, but now it's not nearly as odd because Brock Lesnar isn't at every pay-per-view to defend the championship. But it seemed weird to have the champion there and not be in the main event and just kind of be in what essentially was a throwaway tag because he didn't get any moves in because the Horsemen tried to keep the Taskmaster in there to beat on him and keep the Giant out, which I get is the strategy, but that meant that the Giant literally like hit four moves, and I get it. He was also green as hell, slightly less green and inexperienced than Steve Mongo McMichael was, but it was a weird match. They had a weird dynamic for that and just the situation around it. They explained that part of what was going on briefly. But yeah, yet again, the other match had killed what interest I had. And then when these guys came out, I'm like, even with Benoit in there, knowing how good in the ring he was when he was, you know, still just kind of, I wasn't too invested in this match either.
Right. Well, let's also speak about behind the scenes was being going on, right? So Taskmaster was, a former husband of the woman. And at this point, Chris Benoit was seeing woman, and there was no love lost between Chris Benoit and Kevin Sullivan. So that's actually hatred. So that post-match beating,
that was shoot. That was that, not.
There was some shoot. Benoit was shooting in this match.
And that's why woman came out and was like, "Stop kicking him."
Yes, and then they had to bring Giant back in
to just like, and then you see Benoit like leave just like slowly, casually walk out. Like he wasn't like, oh, it's part of the gimmick. I'm sliding out. Like I knew that it was because of the history between them, and that's what, you know, they ended up doing the tournament match and all of that active right. Competition. But I didn't know for how long it had been going on and if that feud between them had reached the camera yet at this point. Or was this kind of the first time that it really did?
Yeah, it was a thing with those two. I mean, Benoit basically picked up in the feud where Pillman had left off, and it just happened that it was very personal for these two, having to work together and with all the stuff behind the scenes with woman. Of course, we know how all that ended up in the end. But yeah, it was crazy times, and Benoit. Yeah, he hated Kevin Sullivan, and I think the feeling was mutual. Those two was quite something else,
to say the least. Goodness gracious.
All right, so we get to the main event of the evening. And out first come the outsiders, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, no third man. And then all in face paints, ready for war, Sting, Randy Savage, and Lex Luger. And it looks like it's going to be 3-on-2 handicap because there's no third man around. Who is the third man? Where is the third man?
The only information that they give us is that, don't they get on the mic before the face paint guys come out and they're like, he ain't red, you know, blah 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 blah. That's all they say, or like that. We care of these chumps by ourselves. And see, they didn't really show replays or anything, so I don't know. I guess I didn't quite 100% understand what stretcher job Luger, like he hit his head on the metal or something.
Right. So, okay. So what happened was at one point Nash had Luger on the turnbuckle. And then that's when Sting did the Stinger Splash on Kevin Nash. But that squished Luger on the turnbuckle area. And supposedly like, that took him out.
So it squashed on the metal, and that's when he fell, and they took him out on the stretcher because he was hurt. And then they were like, then the whole thing they were talking about, like, how does Sting feel, you know, taking out his partner and friend, and, you know, if they lose this match, you know, just how hard, you know, does Sting blame himself because he hurt his own partner and, you know, then put them at a disadvantage in a turned it into a 2-on-2 match, putting them at a disadvantage, quote unquote. But so that was kind of weird. The match itself was okay, you know, like Randy's running around doing Randy stuff, which is awesome. And, you know, Sting did his Sting stuff and that was cool. And Nash and Hall got each of their stuff in. But then the match just kind of hit, like, yet again, they're talking about these stakes of this takeover, like as though if they win, they win ownership of World Championship Wrestling. You know, that, oh no, if they win, it could be the end. Like, what's going to, like, this could all be over. This could all be gone if they win. Like, and then the match essentially ends in a no contest. And so they're like, things are saved. And then they just spend time downplaying the third man for being a traitor. And you know, how they hope he burns in hell or whatever. Like, Tony Schiavone says something like that towards the end, like, go to hell.
Yeah, that's the way that he closed the show. It was crazy, though. I mean, the match it's a good match, I thought. You know, they did their things. The Outsiders did, you know, what they had to do. Take out Luger. Things were evened out. Savage took a lot of beating, as he usually does. Sting took some beatings as well. They went back and forth until when it looked like all was lost. And then the Outsiders had taken down Sting, and now we're working on Savage, and out came the Hulkster to a huge ovation. Hulkamania was running wild.
He was coming to save the day. He was coming to save the day. He joined Sting and the Macho Man. Heenan said, who's he coming to help? Who's he coming to help? But everybody else was saying, oh, Hogan's coming out to replace Lex Luger on the team and win the day for WCW. Where the big boys play.
And then the leg drop heard around the world.
That he does two more times than thereafter.
But it was perfect because he walked in and it was like, yes, Hawk is going to save us. Hawk is going to, oh my God. And watching that video, seeing the end results, the piles of trash.
The crowd.
Yes, the crowd reactions. You want to talk about heartbreaking, betrayal, just people going up to Hayden an instant.
When was the last time that fans threw that much junk into the ring?
It's been long, because if you do it at a WWE event now, they'll find you and throw you out and ban you for life.
Yeah, but it was crazy, though.
That's what I'm saying. And throughout the tenure of the NWO, whenever it would not be the last time that Hulk Hogan and the Outsiders would be in the ring being pelted with trash while they were talking. Yeah. That became almost like an every other week occurrence when they were beating down somebody and talking and all this to end Nitro, the ring would just start filling up with garbage. It was amazing, amazing stuff.
Truly one of the greatest nights in professional wrestling.
Yeah. And then Hogan cuts the promo and calls it the New World Organization several times, never to be used as the New World Organization ever again.
But it was the NWO. That was the birth of the NWO.
I don't know if they originally wanted it to be the organization and they just decided to change it to Order, or if it was always intended to be Order and it's just one of the earlier famous Hogan flubs like the Silver Dome. and whatever. We mixed up the names of the arena when he was host of WrestleMania.
That was Bash at the Beach 1996, the birth of the NWO and the beginning of the true Monday Night Wars right then and there now, because things started going. Hulk Hogan and the NWO ran wild on WCW and forced WWE to then, back then WWF to change their attitude. And then we got the Attitude Era, the Monday Night Wars were full effect, the ratings bonanza. Everything that basically we all grew up, you talked about, Danny, where like you started watching full-time again a year later. What if Hulk Hogan had been the third man? Could it have worked with anyone else?
It might have, but I think the biggest thing was with Hogan because he was, it wasn't the first time he was heel. He started the business as a heel. I think unless it had Sting, I don't think it would have worked. Because it would have had to have been a super beloved baby face. Because if you picked somebody like Macho Man who was always kind of an in-betweener, even when he was loved, he still did bad guys. He still did kind of heelish stuff. If he did it, I don't think it would have had the same effect. It would have had to have been Hulk Hogan and maybe if Sting had done it. And then Hulk would be the one fighting against them. But in WCW at the time, it pretty much would have had to have been one of those two guys in order to get the effect.
So there you go. We get Hulk Hogan joining the NWO, forming the NWO with the Outsiders. And there we get the beginning of what became one of the biggest factions. And hey, to this world, if we didn't have NWO, would we have DX? Would we have Bullet Club? Would we have everybody two sweeting people right now?
No. The closest we would have would just be even more Four Horsemen clones than we do already.
So that was it. That was our look back at WCW's Bash at the Beach 1996. We'll definitely be doing these more often, at least once a month going forward, as we do go back and look at different shows from time to time. So we'll put our poll on the Twitter machine next month with our couple of options and see what people want to hear about. And you can make sure you check us out on the Twitter machine at FOW Radio. Danny's on Twitter at Danny F. in Danger. Tamika's on Twitter at Mika Villas. I'm on Twitter at YellowmanPA. Subscribe to the FOW Radio Network on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Podbean, and Google Play. And this has been the last episode of the month, as I'm going to be out on vacation, so we're taking a little hiatus. We'll be back in the first week of June. But until then, keep watching wrestling.